This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Drums of Autumn, Part 1, by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. This work is copyrighted 1997 by Diana Gabaldon. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books Incorporated. It began in Scotland, at an ancient stone circle. There, a doorway, open to a select few, leads to the past or to the grave. Claire Randall has survived the extraordinary passage not once, but twice. On her first trip, which took her to the mid-18th century, she met Jamie Fraser, the love of her life, only to be forced to return to her own present, pregnant with his child. Her second journey, 2 decades later, brought them together again in America. But Claire has left someone behind in the 20th century. Their daughter, Brianna. And now, Drums of Autumn.
Prologue. I've never been afraid of ghosts. I live with them daily, after all. When I look in a mirror, my mother's eyes look back at me. My mouth curls with the smile that lured my great-grandfather to the fate that was me. No. How should I fear the touch of those vanished hands, laid on me in love unknowing? How could I be afraid of those that moulded my flesh, leaving their remnants to live long past the grave? Still less could I be afraid of those ghosts who touch my thoughts in passing. Any library is filled with them. I can take a book from dusty shelves and be haunted by the thoughts of one long dead, still lively as ever in their winding sheet of words. Of course, it isn't these homely and accustomed ghosts that trouble sleep and curdle wakefulness. Look back. Hold a torch to light the recesses of the dark. Listen to the footsteps that echo behind when you walk alone. All the time the ghosts flit past and through us, hiding in the future. We look in the mirror and see the shades of other faces, looking back through the years. We see the shape of memory, standing solid in an empty doorway. By blood and by choice, we make our ghosts. We haunt ourselves. Each ghost comes unbidden from the misty grounds of dream and silence. Our rational minds say, no, it isn't. But another part, an older part, echoes always softly in the dark. Yes, but it could be. We come and go from mystery, and in between we try to forget. But a breeze passing in a still room stirs my hair now and then in soft affection. I think it is my mother. Part 1. O Brave New World. Chapter 1. A Hanging in Eden. Charleston, June 1767. I heard the drums long before they came in sight. The beating echoed in the pit of my stomach, as though I too were hollow. The sound travelled through the crowd, a harsh military rhythm meant to be heard over speech or gunfire. I saw heads turn as the people fell silent, looking up the stretch of East Bay Street, where it ran from the half-built skeleton of the new customs house toward White Point Gardens. It was a hot day, even for Charleston in June. The best places were on the sea wall, where the air moved. Here, below, it was like being roasted alive. My shift was soaked through, and the cotton bodice clung between my breasts. I wiped my face for the 10th time in as many minutes and lifted the heavy coil of my hair, hoping vainly for a cooling breeze upon my neck. I was morbidly aware of necks at the moment. Unobtrusively, I put my hand up to the base of my throat, letting my fingers circle it. I could feel the pulse beat in my carotid arteries along with the drums. And when I breathed, the hot, wet air clogged my throat as though I were choking. I quickly took my hand down and drew in a breath as deep as I could manage. That was a mistake. The man in front of me hadn't bathed in a month or more. The edge of the stock about his thick neck was dark with grime, and his clothes smelled sour and musty, pungent even amid the sweaty reek of the crowd. The smell of hot bread and frying pig fat from the food vendors' stalls lay heavy over a musk of rotting seagrass from the marsh, only slightly relieved by a whiff of salt breeze from the harbour. There were several children in front of me, craning and gawking, running out from under the oaks and palmettos to look up the street, being called back by anxious parents. The girl nearest me had a neck like the white part of a grass stalk, slender and succulent. There was a ripple of excitement through the crowd. The gallows procession was in sight at the far end of the street. The drums grew louder. "Where is he?" Fergus muttered beside me, craning his own neck to see. "I knew I should have gone with him."
"He'll be here."
I wanted to stand on tiptoe, but didn't, feeling that this would be undignified. I did glance around, though, searching. I could always spot Jamie in a crowd. He stood head and shoulders above most men, and his hair caught the light in a blaze of reddish gold. There was no sign of him yet, only a bobbing sea of bonnets and tricorns, sheltering from the heat those citizens come too late to find a place in the shade. The flags came first, fluttering above the heads of the excited crowd, the banners of Great Britain and of the Royal Colony of South Carolina, and another bearing the family arms of the Lord Governor of the colony. Then came the drummers, walking two by two in step, their sticks an alternate beat and blur. It was a slow march, grimly inexorable. A dead march, I thought they called that particular cadence. Very suitable under the circumstances. All other noises were drowned by the rattle of the drums. Then came the platoon of red-coated soldiers, and in their midst, the prisoners. There were three of them, hands bound before them, linked together by a chain that ran through rings on the iron collars about their necks. The first man was small and elderly, ragged and disreputable, a shambling wreck who lurched and staggered, so that the dark-suited clergyman who walked beside the prisoners was obliged to grasp his arm to keep him from falling. "Is that Gavin Hayes?" "He looks sick," I murmured to Fergus.
"He's drunk."
The soft voice came from behind me, and I whirled, to find Jamie standing at my shoulder, eyes fixed on the pitiful procession. The small man's disequilibrium was disrupting the progress of the parade, as his stumbling forced the two men chained to him to zig and zag abruptly in order to keep their feet. The general impression was of three inebriates rolling home from the local tavern, grossly at odds with the solemnity of the occasion. I could hear the rustle of laughter over the drums, and shouts and jeers from the crowds on the wrought-iron balconies of the houses on East Bay Street.
"You're doing?"
I spoke quietly so as not to attract notice, but I could have shouted and waved my arms. No one had eyes for anything but the scene before us. I felt, rather than saw, Jamie shrug as he moved forward to stand beside me.
"It was what he asked of me," he said, "and the best I could manage for him." "Brandy or whiskey?"
asked Fergus, evaluating Hayes's appearance with a practised eye.
"The man's a Scot, wee Fergus."
Jamie's voice was as calm as his face, but I heard the small note of strain in it.
"Whiskey's what he wanted." "A wise choice. With luck, he won't even notice when they hang him," Fergus muttered.
The small man had slipped from the preacher's grasp and fallen flat on his face in the sandy road, pulling one of his companions to his knees. The last prisoner, a tall young man, stayed on his feet, but swayed wildly from side to side, trying desperately to keep his balance. The crowd on the point roared with glee. The captain of the guard glowed crimson between the white of his wig and the metal of his gorget, flushed with fury as much as with sun. He barked an order as the drums continued their sombre roll, and a soldier scrambled hastily to remove the chain that bound the prisoners together. Hayes was jerked unceremoniously to his feet, a soldier grasping each arm, and the procession resumed in better order. There was no laughter by the time they reached the gallows, a mule-drawn cart placed beneath the limbs of a huge live oak. I could feel the drums beating through the soles of my feet. I felt slightly sick from the sun and the smells. The drums stopped abruptly, and my ears rang in the silence.
"You didn't need to watch it, Sassenach," Jamie whispered to me. "Go back to the wagon."
His own eyes were fixed unblinkingly on Hayes, who swayed and mumbled in the soldier's grasp, looking blearily around.
The last thing I wanted was to watch, but neither could I leave Jamie to see it through alone. He had come for Gavin Hayes. I had come for him.
I touched his hand. "I'll stay."
Jamie drew himself straighter, squaring his shoulders. He moved a pace forward, making sure that he was visible in the crowd. If Hayes was still sober enough to see anything, the last thing he saw on earth would be the face of a friend.
He could see.
Hayes glared to and fro as they lifted him into the cart, twisting his neck, desperately looking. "Gavin! Aharich!" Jamie shouted suddenly.
Hayes' eyes found him at once, and he ceased struggling.
The little man stood swaying slightly as the charge was read. Theft in the amount of £6.10. He was covered in reddish dust, and pearls of sweat clung trembling to the grey stubble of his beard. The preacher was leaning close, murmuring urgently in his ear. Then the drums began again, in a steady roll. The hangman guided the noose over the balding head and fixed it tight, not positioned precisely just under the ear. The captain of the guard stood poised, sabre raised. Suddenly, the condemned man drew himself up straight. Eyes on Jamie, he opened his mouth as though to speak. The sabre flashed in the morning sun, and the drum stopped with a final thunk. I looked at Jamie. He was white to the lips, eyes fixed wide. From the corner of my eye, I could see the twitching rope and the faint reflexive jerk of the dangling sack of clothes. A sharp stink of urine and feces struck through the thick air.
On my other side, Fergus watched dispassionately.
"I suppose he noticed, after all," he murmured, with regret.
The body swung slightly, a dead weight oscillating like a plumb bob on its string. There was a sigh from the crowd of awe and release. Terns squawked from the burning sky, and the harbour sounds came faint and smothered through the heavy air, but the point was wrapped in silence. From where I stood, I could hear the small plit, plat, plit of the drops that fell from the toe of the corpse's dangling shoe. I hadn't known Gavin Hayes, and felt no personal grief for his death, but I was glad it had been quick. I stole a glance at him with an odd feeling of intrusion. It was a most public way of accomplishing a most private act, and I felt vaguely embarrassed to be looking. The hangman had known his business. There had been no undignified struggle, no staring eyes, no protruding tongue. Gavin's small round head tilted sharply to the side, neck grotesquely stretched, but cleanly broken. It was a clean break, in more ways than one. The captain of the guard, satisfied that Hayes was dead, motioned with his sabre for the next man to be brought to the gibbet. I saw his eyes travel down the red-clad file and then widen in outrage. At the same time, there was a cry from the crowd and a ripple of excitement that quickly spread. Heads turned and people pushed, each against his neighbour, striving to see where there was nothing to be seen.
"He's gone! There he goes! Stop him!"
It was the third prisoner, the tall young man, who had seized the moment of Gavin's death to run for his life, sliding past the guard who should have been watching him, but who had been unable to resist the gallows' fascination. I saw a flicker of movement behind a vendor's stall, a flash of dirty blonde hair. Some of the soldiers saw it too, and ran in that direction. But many more were rushing in other directions, and among the collisions and confusion, nothing was accomplished. The captain of the guard was shouting, face purple,
his voice barely audible over the uproar. The remaining prisoner, looking stunned, was seized and hustled back in the direction of the court of guard as the redcoats began hastily to sort themselves back into order under the lash of their captain's voice. Jamie snaked an arm around my waist and dragged me out of the way of an oncoming wave of humanity. The crowd fell back before the advance of squads of soldiers, who formed up and marched briskly off to quarter the area, under the grim and furious direction of their sergeant.
"We'd best find Ian," Jamie said, fending off a group of excited apprentices.
He glanced at Fergus and jerked his head toward the gibbet and its melancholy burden.
"Claim the body, aye. We'll meet at the willow tree later."
"Do you think they'll catch him?" I asked, as we pushed through the ebbing crowd, threading our way down a cobbled lane toward the merchant's wharves.
"I expect so. Where can he go?"
He spoke abstractedly, a narrow line visible between his brows. Plainly, the dead man was still on his mind, and he had little attention to spare for the living. "Did Hayes have any family?" I asked. He shook his head.
"I asked him that when I brought him the whiskey. He thought he might have a brother left alive, but no notion where. The brother was transported soon after the rising. To Virginia, he thought. But he'd heard nothing since."
Not surprising if he hadn't. An indentured labourer would have had no facilities for communicating with kin left behind in Scotland, unless the bondsman's employer was kind enough to send a letter on his behalf. And, kind or not, it was unlikely that a letter would have found Gavin Hayes, who had spent 10 years in Ardsmuir prison before being transported in his turn.
"Duncan!"
Jamie called out. And a tall, thin man turned and raised a hand in acknowledgement. He made his way through the crowd in a corkscrew fashion, his single arm swinging in a wide arc that fended off the passers-by.
"MacDhu," he said, bobbing his head in greeting to Jamie. "Mrs. Clare?"
His long, narrow face was furrowed with sadness. He, too, had once been a prisoner at Ardsmuir, with Hayes and with Jamie. Only the loss of his arm to a blood infection had prevented his being transported with the others. Unfit to be sold for labour, he had instead been pardoned and set free to starve, until Jamie had found him.
"God rest poor Gavin," Duncan said, shaking his head dolorously.
Jamie muttered something in response in Gaelic and crossed himself. Then he straightened, casting off the oppression of the day with a visible effort.
"Aye, well, I must go to the docks and arrange about Ian's passage, and then we'll think of burying Gavin. But I must have the lad settled first."
We struggled through the crowd toward the docks, squeezing our way between knots of excited gossipers, eluding the drays and barrows that came and went through the press with the ponderous indifference of trade. A file of red-coated soldiers came at the quick march from the other end of the quay, splitting the crowd like vinegar dropped on mayonnaise. The sun glittered hot on the line of bayonet points, and the rhythm of their tramping beat through the noise of the crowd like a muffled drum. Even the rumbling sledges and hand-carts stopped abruptly to let them pass by.
"Mind your pockets, Asenach,"
Jamie murmured in my ear, ushering me through a narrow space between a turban-clad slave clutching two small children and a street preacher perched on a box. He was shouting sin and repentance, but with only one word in three audible through the noise. "I sewed it shut," I assured him, nonetheless reaching to touch the small weight that swung against my thigh. "What about yours?" He grinned and tilted his hat forward, dark blue eyes narrowing against the bright sunlight.
"It's where my sporran would be, did I have one. So long as I dinna meet with a quick-fingered harlot, I'm safe."
I glanced at the slightly bulging front of his breeches, and then up at him. Broad-shouldered and tall, with bold, clean features, and a Highlander's proud carriage, he drew the glance of every woman he passed, even with his bright hair covered by a sober blue tricorne.
The breeches, which were borrowed, were substantially too tight, and did nothing whatever to detract from the general effect, an effect enhanced by the fact that he himself was totally ignorant of it. "You're a walking inducement to harlots," I said. "Stick by me. I'll protect you." He laughed and took my arm as we emerged into a small, clear space.
"Ian!"
he shouted, catching sight of his nephew over the heads of the crowd. A moment later, a tall, stringy gawk of a boy popped out of the crowd, pushing a thatch of brown hair out of his eyes and grinning widely.
"I thought I should never find you, Uncle," he exclaimed. "Christ, there are more folk here than at the lawn market in Edinburgh."
He wiped a coat sleeve across his long, half-homely face, leaving a streak of grime down one cheek. Jamie eyed his nephew askance.
"You're looking indecently cheerful, Ian, for having just seen a man go to his death."
Ian hastily altered his expression into an attempt at decent solemnity.
"Oh, no, Uncle Jamie," he said. "I didn't see the hanging."
Duncan raised one brow, and Ian blushed slightly.
I wasn't afraid to see it. It was only I had something else I wanted to do."
Jamie smiled slightly and patted his nephew on the back.
"Don't trouble yourself, Ian. I'd as soon not have seen it myself. Only that Gavin was a friend."
"I know, Uncle. I'm sorry for it."
A flash of sympathy showed in the boy's large brown eyes, the only feature of his face with any claim to beauty. He glanced at me.
"Was it awful, Auntie?"
"Yes," I said. "It's over, though." I pulled the damp handkerchief out of my bosom and stood on tiptoe to rub away the smudge on his cheek. Duncan Innes shook his head sorrowfully.
"Aye, poor Gavin. Still, it's a quicker death than starving, and there was little left for him but that." "Let's go," Jamie interrupted, unwilling to spend time in useless lamenting. "The Bonnie Mary should be near the far end of the quay."
I saw Ian glance at Jamie and draw himself up as though about to speak, but Jamie had already turned toward the harbour and was shoving his way through the crowd. Ian glanced at me, shrugged, and offered me an arm. We followed Jamie behind the warehouses that lined the docks, sidestepping sailors, loaders, slaves, passengers, customers, and merchants of all sorts. Charleston was a major shipping port, and business was booming, with as many as 100 ships a month coming and going from Europe in the season. The Bonnie Mary belonged to a friend of Jamie's cousin, Jared Fraser, who had gone to France to make his fortune in the wine business and succeeded brilliantly. With luck, the Bonnie Mary's captain might be persuaded, for Jared's sake, to take Ian with him back to Edinburgh, allowing the boy to work his passage as a cabin lad. Ian wasn't enthused at the prospect, but Jamie was determined to ship his errant nephew back to Scotland at the earliest opportunity. It was, among other concerns, news of the Bonnie Mary's presence in Charleston that had brought us here from Georgia, where we had first set foot in America, by accident, 2 months before. As we passed a tavern, a slatternly barmaid came out with a bowl of slops. She caught sight of Jamie and stood, bowl braced against her hip, giving him a slanted brow and a pouting smile. He passed without a glance, intent on his goal. She tossed her head, flung the slops to the pig, who slept by the step, and flounced back inside. He paused, shading his eyes to look down the row of towering ship's masts, and I came up beside him. He twitched unconsciously at the front of his breeches, easing the fit, and I took his arm. "Family jewels still safe, are they?" I murmured.
"Uncomfortable, but safe," he assured me.
He plucked at the lacing of his flies, grimacing.
"I would have done better to hide them up my bum, I think." "Better you than me, mate," I said, smiling. "I'd rather risk robbery myself."
The family jewels were just that. We had been driven ashore on the coast of Georgia by a hurricane, arriving soaked, ragged, and destitute, save for a handful of large and valuable gemstones. I hope the captain of the Bonnie Mary thought highly enough of Jared Fraser to accept Ian as a cabin boy, because if not, we were going to have a spot of difficulty about the passage. In theory, Jamie's pouch and my pocket contained a sizable fortune. In practice, the stones might have been beach pebbles so far as the good they were to us. While gems were an easy, compact way of transporting wealth, the problem was changing them back into money. Most trade in the southern colonies was conducted by means of barter. What wasn't was handled by the exchange of scrip or bills written on a wealthy merchant or banker. And wealthy bankers were thin on the ground in Georgia. Those willing to tie up their available capital in gemstones, rarer still. The prosperous rice farmer with whom we had stayed in Savannah had assured us that he himself could scarcely lay his hand on £2 sterling in cash. Indeed, there was likely not £10 in gold and silver to be had in the whole colony. Nor was there any chance of selling one of the stones in the endless stretches of salt marsh and pine forest through which we had passed on our journey north. Charleston was the first city we had reached of sufficient size to harbour merchants and bankers who might help to liquidate a portion of our frozen assets. Not that anything was likely to stay frozen long in Charleston in summer, I reflected. Rivulets of sweat were running down my neck, and the linen shift under my bodice was soaked and crumpled against my skin. Even so close to the harbour, there was no wind at this time of day, and the smells of hot tar, dead fish, and sweating labourers was nearly overwhelming. Despite their protestations, Jamie had insisted on giving one of our gemstones to Mr. and Mrs. Olivier, the kindly people who had taken us in when we were shipwrecked virtually on their doorstep, as some token of thanks for their hospitality. In return, they had provided us with a wagon, 2 horses, fresh clothes for travelling, food for the journey north, and a small amount of money. Of this, 6 shillings and 3 pence remained in my pocket, constituting the entirety of our disposable fortune.
"This way, Uncle Jamie," Ian said,
turning and beckoning his uncle eagerly.
"I've got something to show you."
"What is it?" Jamie asked, threading his way through a throng of sweating slaves who were loading dusty bricks of dried indigo into an anchored cargo ship.
"And how did you get whatever it is? You haven't got any money, have you?" "No, I won it dicing."
Ian's voice floated back, his body invisible as he skipped around a cartload of corn.
"Dicing? Ian, for God's sake, you cannae be gambling when you've not a penny to bless yourself with."
Holding my arm, Jamie shoved away through the crowd to catch up to his nephew.
"You do it all the time, Uncle Jamie," the boy pointed out, pausing to wait for us. "You've been doing it in every tavern and inn where we've stayed." "My God, Ian, that's cards, not dice, and I know what I'm doing." "So do I," said Ian, looking smug. "A one, no?"
Jamie rolled his eyes toward heaven, imploring patience.
"Here's you, Ian. But I'm glad you're going home before you get your head beaten in. Promise me you will not be gambling with the sailors, aye? You cannae get away from them on a ship."
Ian was paying no attention. He had come to a half-crumbled piling around which was tied a stout rope. Here he stopped and turned to face us, gesturing at an object by his feet.
"See? It's a dog," Ian said proudly.
I took a quick half-step behind Jamie, grabbing his arm. "Ian," I said, "that is not a dog. It's a wolf. It's a bloody big wolf, and I think you ought to get away from it before it takes a bite out of your arse." The wolf twitched one ear negligently in my direction, dismissed me, and twitched it back. It continued to sit, panting with the heat, its big yellow eyes fixed on Ian with an intensity that might have been taken for devotion by someone who hadn't met a wolf before. I had.
"Those things are dangerous," I said. "They'd bite you as soon as look at you."
Disregarding this, Jamie stooped to inspect the beast.
"It's not quite a wolf, is it?"
Sounding interested, he held out a loose fist to the so-called dog, inviting it to smell his knuckles.
I closed my eyes, expecting the imminent amputation of his hand.
Hearing no shrieks, I opened them again to find him squatting on the ground, peering up the animal's nostrils.
"He's a handsome creature, Ian," he said,
scratching the thing familiarly under the chin. The yellow eyes narrowed slightly, either in pleasure at the attention or, more likely, I thought, in anticipation of biting off Jamie's nose.
"Bigger than a wolf, though. It's broader through the head and chest, and a deal longer in the leg. His mother was an Irish wolfhound."
Ian was hunkered down by Jamie, eagerly explaining as he stroked the enormous grey-brown back.
"She got out in heat into the woods, and when she came back, in whelp..." "Oh, aye, I see."
Now Jamie was crooning in Gaelic to the monster while he picked up its huge foot and fondled its hairy toes. The curved black claws were a good 2 inches long. The thing half closed its eyes, the faint breeze ruffling the thick fur at its neck. I glanced at Duncan, who arched his eyebrows at me, shrugged slightly, and sighed. Duncan didn't care for dogs.
"Jamie," I said.
"Balach boyach," Jamie said to the wolf. "Are you no the bonny laddie, then?"
"What would he eat?" I asked, somewhat more loudly than necessary. Jamie stopped caressing the beast.
"Oh," he said.
He looked at the yellow-eyed thing with some regret.
"Well,"
he rose to his feet, shaking his head reluctantly.
"I'm afraid your auntie's right, Ian. How are we to feed him?"
"Oh, that's no trouble, Uncle Jimmy," Ian assured him. "He hunts for himself."
"Here?" I glanced around at the warehouses and the stuccoed row of shops beyond. "What does he hunt? Small children?" Ian looked mildly hurt.
"Of course not, Auntie. Fish."
Seeing three sceptical faces surrounding him, Ian dropped to his knees and grabbed the beast's muzzle in both hands, prying his mouth open.
"He does! I swear, Uncle Jamie! Here, just smell his breath!"
Jamie cast a dubious glance at the double row of impressively gleaming fangs on display and rubbed his chin.
"Aye, I shall take your word for it, Ian. But even so, for Christ's sake, be careful of your fingers, lad!"
Ian's grip had loosened and the massive jaws clashed shut, spraying droplets of saliva over the stone key.
"I'm all right, Uncle," Ian said cheerfully, wiping his hand on his breeks. "He wouldn't bite me, I'm sure. His name is Rollo."
Jamie rubbed his knuckles across his upper lip.
"Well, whatever his name is and whatever he eats, I dinna think the captain of the Bonnie Mary will take kindly to his presence in the crew's quarters."
Ian didn't say anything, but the look of happiness on his face didn't diminish. In fact, it grew. Jamie glanced at him, caught sight of his glowing face, and stiffened.
"No," he said, in horror. "Oh, no."
"Yes," said Ian.
A wide smile of delight split his bony face.
"She sailed 3 days ago, Uncle. We're too late."
Jamie said something in Gaelic that I didn't understand. Duncan looked scandalized.
"Damn,"
Jamie said, reverting to English.
"Bloody damn."
Jamie took off his hat and rubbed a hand over his face, hard. He looked hot, dishevelled, and thoroughly disgruntled. He opened his mouth, thought better of whatever he had been going to say, closed it, and ran his fingers roughly through his hair, jerking loose the ribbon that tied it back. Ian looked abashed.
"I'm sorry, Uncle. I'll try not to be a worry to you. Truly I will. And I can work. I'll earn enough for my food."
Jamie's face softened as he looked at his nephew. He sighed deeply and patted Ian's shoulder.
"It's not that I dinna want you, Ian. You know I should like nothing better than to keep you with me. But what in hell will your mother say?"
The glow returned to Ian's face.
"I dinna ken, Uncle," he said. but she'll be seeing it in Scotland, won't she? And we're here.
He put his arms around Rollo and hugged him. The wolf seemed mildly taken aback by the gesture, but after a moment put out a long pink tongue and daintily licked Ian's ear. Testing him for flavour, I thought cynically.
Besides, the boy added, she kens well enough that I'm safe. You wrote from Georgia to see I was with you.
Jamie summoned a wry smile.
I canna see that that particular bit of knowledge will be ower comforting to her, Ian. She's known me a long time, aye?
He sighed and clapped the hat back on his head and turned to me.
I badly need a drink, Sassenach, he said. Let's find that tavern.
The willow tree was dark and might have been cool had there been fewer people in it. As it was, the benches and tables were crowded with sightseers from the hanging and sailors from the docks, and the atmosphere was like a sweat bath. I inhaled as I stepped into the tap room, then let my breath out fast. It was like breathing through a wad of soiled laundry soaked in beer. Rollo at once proved his worth, parting the crowd like the Red Sea as he stalked through the tap room, lips drawn back from his teeth in a constant, inaudible growl. He was evidently no stranger to taverns. Having satisfactorily cleared out a corner bench, he curled up under the table and appeared to go to sleep. Out of the sun, with a large pewter mug of dark ale foaming gently in front of him, Jamie quickly regained his normal self-possession.
"We've the two choices," he said, brushing back the sweat-soaked hair from his temples. "We can stay in Charleston long enough to maybe find a buyer for one of the stones, and perhaps book passage for Ian to Scotland on another ship. Or we can make our way north to Cape Fear, and maybe find a ship for him out of Wilmington or New Bern." "I say north," Duncan said, without hesitation. "You've kin in Cape Fear, no? I mislike the thought of staying ower long among strangers, and your kinsmen would see we were not cheated nor robbed. Here," he lifted one shoulder in eloquent indication of the un-Scottish, and thus patently dishonest, persons surrounding us. "Oh, do let's go north, uncle," Ian said quickly, before Jamie could reply to this.
He wiped away a small moustache of ale foam with his sleeve.
"The journey might be dangerous. You'll need an extra man along for protection, aye?"
Jamie buried his expression in his own cup, but I was seated close enough to feel a subterranean quiver go through him. Jamie was indeed very fond of his nephew. The fact remained that Ian was the sort of person to whom things happened. Usually through no fault of his own, but still, they happened. The boy had been kidnapped by pirates the year before, and it was the necessity of rescuing him that had brought us by circuitous and often dangerous means to America. Nothing had happened recently, but I knew Jamie was anxious to get his 15-year-old nephew back to Scotland and his mother before something did.
"Ah, to be sure, Ian," Jamie said, lowering his cup.
He carefully avoided meeting my gaze, but I could see the corner of his mouth twitching.
"You'd be a great help, I'm sure, but..."
"We might meet with Red Indians," Ian said, eyes wide.
His face, already a rosy brown from the sun, glowed with a flush of pleasurable anticipation.
"Or wild beasts. Dr. Stern told me that the wilderness of Carolina is alive with fierce creatures, bears and wild cats and wicked panthers, and a great foul thing the Indians call a skunk."
I choked on my ale.
"Are you all right, Auntie?"
Ian leaned anxiously across the table.
"Fine,"
I wheezed, wiping my streaming face with my kerchief. I blotted the drops of spilled ale off my bosom, pulling the fabric of my bodice discreetly away from my flesh in hopes of admitting a little air. Then I caught a glimpse of Jamie's face, on which the expression of suppressed amusement had given way to a small frown of concern.
"Skunks aren't dangerous,"
I murmured, laying a hand on his knee. A skilled and fearless hunter in his native highlands, Jamie was inclined to regard the unfamiliar fauna of the New World with caution.
Mm-hmm.
The frown eased, but a narrow line remained between his brows.
Maybe so, but what are the other things? I canna say I wish to be meeting a bear or a pack of savages with only this to hand.
He touched the large sheathed knife that hung from his belt. Our lack of weapons had worried Jamie considerably on the trip from Georgia, and Ian's remarks about Indians and wild animals had brought the concern to the forefront of his mind once more. Beside Jamie's knife, Fergus bore a smaller blade, suitable for cutting rope and trimming twigs for kindling. That was the full extent of our armoury. The Oliviers had had neither guns nor swords to spare. On the journey from Georgia to Charleston, we had had the company of a group of rice and indigo farmers, all bristling with knives, pistols and muskets, bringing their produce to the port to be shipped north to Pennsylvania and New York. If we left for Cape Fear now, we would be alone, unarmed, and essentially defenceless against anything that might emerge from the thick forests. At the same time, there were pressing reasons to travel north, our lack of available capital being one. Cape Fear was the largest settlement of Scottish Highlanders in the American colonies, boasting several towns whose inhabitants had emigrated from Scotland during the last 20 years following the upheaval after Culloden. And among these emigrants were Jamie's kin, who I knew would willingly offer us refuge, a roof, a bed, and time to establish ourselves in this new world. Jamie took another drink and nodded at Duncan.
I must say I'm of your mind, Duncan.
He leaned back against the wall of the tavern, glancing casually around the crowded room.
Do you no feel the eyes on your back?
A chill ran down my own back, despite the trickle of sweat doing likewise. Duncan's eyes widened fractionally, then narrowed, but he didn't turn around.
Ah, he said. Whose eyes? I asked, looking rather nervously around. I didn't see anyone taking particular notice of us, though anyone might be watching surreptitiously.
The tavern was seething with alcohol-soaked humanity, and the babble of voices was loud enough to drown out all but the closest conversation.
Anyone, Sassenach, Jamie answered.
He glanced sideways at me and smiled.
Dinna look so scared about it, eh? We're in no danger. Not here. Not yet, Innes said.
He leaned forward to pour another cup of ale.
MacDoo called out to Gavin on the gallows, do you see? There will be those who took notice. MacDoo being the bitty wee fellow he is, he added dryly. And the farmers who came with us from Georgia will have sold their stores by now, and will be taking their ease in places like this, Jamie said, evidently absorbed in studying the pattern of his cup. All of them are honest men, but they'll talk Sassenach. It makes a good story, no? The folks cast away by the hurricane. And what are the chances that at least one of them kens a bit about what we carry?
I see, I murmured, and did. We had attracted public interest by our association with a criminal and could no longer pass as inconspicuous travellers. If finding a buyer took some time, as was likely, we risked inviting robbery from unscrupulous persons or scrutiny from the English authorities. Neither prospect was appealing. Jamie lifted his cup and drank deeply, then set it down with a sigh.
No, I think it's perhaps not wise to linger in the city. We'll see Gavin buried decently, and then we'll find a safe spot in the woods outside the town to sleep. Tomorrow we can decide whether to stay or go.
The thought of spending several more nights in the woods, with or without skunks, wasn't appealing. I hadn't taken my dress off in 8 days, merely rinsing the outlying portions of my anatomy whenever we paused in the vicinity of a stream. I'd been looking forward to a real bed, even if flea-infested, and a chance to scrub off the grime of the last week's travel. Still, he had a point. I sighed, ruefully eyeing the hem of my sleeve, grey and grubby with wear. The tavern door flung suddenly open at this point, distracting me from my contemplation, and four red-coated soldiers shoved their way into the crowded room. They wore full uniform, held muskets with bayonets fixed, and were obviously not in pursuit of ale or dice. Two of the soldiers made a rapid circuit of the room, glancing under tables, while another disappeared into the kitchen beyond. The fourth remained on watch by the door, pale eyes flicking over the crowd. His gaze lighted on our table and rested on us for a moment, full of speculation, but then passed on, restlessly seeking. Jamie was outwardly tranquil, sipping his ale in apparent obliviousness, but I saw the hand in his lap clench slowly into a fist. Duncan, less able to control his feelings, bent his head to hide his expression. Neither man would ever feel at ease in the presence of a red coat, and for good reason. No one else appeared much perturbed by the soldier's presence. The little knot of singers in the chimney corner went on with an interminable version of "Fill Every Glass," and a loud argument broke out between the barmaid and a pair of apprentices. The soldier returned from the kitchen, having evidently found nothing. Stepping rudely through a dice game on the hearth, he rejoined his fellows by the door. As the soldiers shoved their way out of the tavern, Fergus's slight figure squeezed in, pressing against the door jamb to avoid swinging elbows and musket butts. I saw one soldier's eyes catch the glint of metal and fasten with interest on the hook Fergus wore in replacement of his missing left hand. He glanced sharp at Fergus, but then shouldered his musket and hurried after his companion. Fergus shoved through the crowd and plopped down on the bench beside Ian. He looked hot and irritated.
"Blood-sucking Selu," he said, without preamble.
Jamie's brows went up.
"The priest,"
Fergus elaborated. He took the mug Ian pushed in his direction and drained it, lean throat glugging until the cup was empty. He lowered it, exhaled heavily, and sat blinking, looking noticeably happier. He sighed and wiped his mouth.
"He wants 10 shillings to bury the man in the churchyard," he said. "An Anglican church, of course. There are no Catholic churches here. Wretched usurer! He knows we have no choice about it. The body will scarcely keep till sunset as it is."
He ran a finger inside his stock, pulling the sweat-wilted cotton away from his neck, then banged his fist several times on the table to attract the attention of the serving maid, who was being run off her feet by the press of patrons.
"I told the super-fatted son of a pig that you would decide whether to pay or not. We could just bury him in the wood, after all. Though we should have to purchase a shovel," he added, frowning. "These grasping townsfolk know we are strangers. They'll take our last coin if they can."
Last coin was perilously close to the truth. I had enough to pay for a decent meal here, and to buy food for the journey north. Perhaps enough to pay for a couple of nights' lodging. That was all. I saw Jamie's eyes flick round the room, assessing the possibilities of picking up a little money at Hazard or Loo. Soldiers and sailors were the best prospects for gambling, but there were few of either in the tap room. Likely most of the garrison was still searching the town for the fugitive. In one corner, a small group of men was being loudly convivial over several pitchers of brandywine. Two of them were singing, or trying to, their attempts causing great hilarity among their comrades. Jamie gave an almost imperceptible nod at sight of them, and turned back to Fergus.
"What have you done with Gavin for the time being?" Jamie asked.
Fergus hunched one shoulder.
"Put him in the wagon. I traded the clothes he was wearing to a rag woman for a shroud, and she agreed to wash the body as part of the bargain."
He gave Jamie a faint smile.
"Don't worry, milor. He's seemly. For now," he added,
lifting the fresh mug of ale to his lips.
Poor Gavin.
Duncan Innes lifted his own mug in a half-salute to his fallen comrade.
Slange,
Jamie replied, and lifted his own mug in reply. He set it down and sighed.
You wouldn't like being buried in the wood, he said.
Why not? I asked, curious. I shouldn't think it would matter to him one way or the other.
Oh, no, we couldn't do that, Mrs. Clare.
Duncan was shaking his head emphatically. Duncan was normally a most reserved man, and I was surprised at so much apparent feeling.
He was afraid of the dark,
Jamie said softly. I turned to stare at him, and he gave me a lopsided smile.
I lived with Gavin Hayes nearly as long as I've lived with you, Sassenach, and in much closer quarters. I kent him well. Aye, he was afraid of being alone in the dark, Duncan chimed in. He was most mortally scared of Tanaskach. Of spirits, aye.
His long, mournful face bore an inward look, and I knew he was seeing in memory the prison cell that he and Jamie had shared with Gavin Hayes, and with 40 other men, for 3 long years.
Do you recall, MacDhu, how he told us one night of the Tanask he met? I do, Duncan, and could wish I did not.
Jamie shuddered despite the heat.
I kept awake myself half the night after he told us that one. What was it, Uncle?
Ian was leaning over his cup of ale, round-eyed. His cheeks were flushed and streaming, and his stock crumpled with sweat. Jamie rubbed a hand across his mouth, thinking.
Ah, well, it was the time in the late cold autumn in the Highlands, just when the season turns, and the feel of the air tells you the ground will be shivered wi' frost come dawn, he said.
He settled himself in his seat and sat back, ale cup in hand. He smiled wryly, plucking at his own throat.
Not like now, eh? Well, Gavin's son brought back the kine that night, but there was one beast missing. The lad had hunted up the hills and down the quarries, but couldn't find it anywhere. So Gavin set the lad to milk the 2 others, and set out himself to look for the lost cow.
He rolled the pewter cup slowly between his hands, staring down into the dark ale, as though seeing in it the bulk of the night-black Scottish peaks and the mist that floats in the autumn glens.
He went some distance, and the cot behind him disappeared. When he looked back, he couldn't see the light from the window any more, and there was no sound but the keening of the wind. It was cold, but he went on tramping through the mud and the heather, hearing the crackle of ice under his boots. He saw a small grove through the mist, and thinking the cow might have taken shelter beneath the trees, he went toward it. He said the trees were birches, standing there all leafless, but with their branches grown together, so he must bend his head to squeeze beneath the boughs. He came into the grove, and saw it was not a grove at all, but a circle of trees. There were great tall trees spaced very evenly all around him, and smaller ones, saplings, grown up between to make a wall of branches. And in the centre of the circle stood a cairn.
Hot as it was in the tavern, I felt as though a sliver of ice had slid melting down my spine. I had seen ancient cairns in the Highlands myself, and found them eerie enough in the broad light of day. Jamie took a sip of ale, and wiped away a trickle of sweat that ran down his temple.
He felt quite queer, did Gavin, for he kent the place. Everyone did, and kept well away from it. It was a strange place, and it seemed even worse in the dark and the cold from what it did in the light of day. It was an old cairn, the kind laid wi' slabs of rock, all heaped round wi' stones, and he could see before him the black opening of the tomb. He knew it was a place no man should come, and he without a powerful charm. Gavin had naught but a wooden cross about his neck, so he crossed himself with it and turned to go.
Jamie paused to sip his ale.
But as Gavin went from the grove, he said softly, he heard footsteps behind him.
I saw the Adam's apple bob in Ian's throat as he swallowed. He reached mechanically for his own cup, eyes fixed on his uncle.
"It didn't turn to see," Jamie went on, but kept walking. And the steps kept pace with him, step by step, always following. And he came through the peat where the water seeps up and it was crusted with ice, the weather being so cold. He could hear the peat crackle under his feet, and behind him, the crack, crack of breaking ice. He walked and he walked through the cool, dark night, watching ahead for the light of his own window, where his wife had set the candle. But the light never showed, and he began to fear he had lost his way among the heather and the dark hills. And all the time, the steps kept pace with him, loud in his ears. At last he could bear it no more, and seizing hold of the crucifix he wore round his neck, he swung about with a great cry to face whatever followed.
What did he see?
Ian's pupils were dilated, dark with drink and wonder. Jamie glanced at the boy, and then at Duncan, nodding at him to take up the story.
"He said it was a figure like a man, but with no body," Duncan said quietly. "All white, like as it might have been made of the mist, but with great holes where its eyes should be, and empty black, fit to draw the soul from his body with dread." But Gavin held up his cross before his face, and he prayed aloud to the Blessed Virgin.
Jamie took up the story, leaning forward intently, the dim firelight outlining his profile in gold.
And the thing came no nearer, but stayed there, watching him. And so he began to walk backward, not daring to face round again. He walked backward, stumbling and slipping, fearing every moment as he might tumble into a burn or down a cliff and break his neck, but fearing worse to turn his back on the cold thing. He couldn't tell how long he'd walked, only that his legs were trembling with weariness, when at last he caught a glimpse of light through the mist, and there was his own cottage with a candle in the window. He cried out in joy and turned to his door. But the cold thing was quick, and slip it past him to stand betwixt him and the door. His wife had been watching out for him, and when she heard him cry out, she came at once to the door. Gavin shouted to her not to come out, but for God's sake to fetch a charm to drive away the tanask. Quick as thought, she snatched the pot from beneath her bed, and a twig of myrtle bound with red thread and black that she'd made to bless the cows. She dashed the water against the doorposts, and the cold thing leapt upward astride the lintel. Gavin rushed in between and barred the door, and stayed inside in his wife's arms until the dawn. They let the candle burn all the night, and Gavin Hayes never again left his house past sunset, until he went to fight for Prince Charlach.
Even Duncan, who knew the tale, sighed as Jamie finished speaking. Ian crossed himself, then looked about self-consciously, but no one seemed to have noticed.
"So, now Gavin has gone into the dark," Jamie said softly. "But we will not let him lie in unconsecrated ground." "Did they find the cow?" Fergus asked with his usual practicality.
Jamie quirked one eyebrow at Duncan, who answered,
"Oh, aye, they did. The next morning they found the poor beast with her hooves all clogged with mud and stones, staring mad and lathered about the muzzle, and her sides heaving fit to burst."
He glanced from me to Ian and back to Fergus.
"See," he said precisely, "that she looked as though she'd been ridden to hell and back."
"Jesus!"
Ian took a deep gulp of his ale, and I did the same. In the corner, the drinking society was making attempts on a round of Captain Thunder, breaking down each time in helpless laughter. Ian put down his cup on the table.